riding the rails. One thing Joe does know is trains, and he made sure everyone in America knew about his love for taxpayer-subsidized Amtrak. He repeatedly told a folksy story of riding the rails from Wilmington to Washington, D.C., and back. Just your ordinary working dad taking public transportation daily to earn a living and get back home to his family. He brought journalists with him on the journey and schmoozed with passengers to demonstrate his everyman cred. Citing his train travel, Beltway journalist turned Obama flack Linda Douglas gushed about Biden. He's not a creature of Washington. She dug deeper. He goes home on the train, eats dinner with his family. He's the epitome of a regular guy. This Joe the Commuter narrative demonstrates the exact opposite, that Biden is indeed the consummate creature of Washington. As an Amtrak-designated champion of the rails, he has lobbied for decades to preserve the government-funded, money-losing Amtrak operation. He signed on as a co-sponsor of legislation reauthorizing the beleaguered government enterprise, which received $1.3 billion in federal subsidies in 2008. Former President George Bush signed the bill in October 2008, doubling funding for Amtrak to an estimated $13 billion over 5 years. The rail line is important to Biden's home state's economy. The tiny state of Delaware doesn't have commercial air service. Joe Biden's daily trips to D.C. on the high-speed Acela line were out of reach for your average blue-collar Joes. It's a $172 round trip from Wilmington, or more than $1,000 for a monthly pass. Unlike ordinary folks, U.S. Senate members are eligible for a federal discount. Or, like Joe Biden, they can use campaign money to pay for trips if they involve a campaign-related meeting or event. The New York Times found that Biden's Amtrak campaign expenses have remained high even in the years without elections, when he was not actively campaigning and his committee retained a handful of part-time staff members and almost no consultants. In 2003, for instance, after he had just easily won re-election to another six-year term, his committee spent $10,874 on Amtrak tickets. That same year, the campaigns of Senator Tom Carper and Representative Mike Castle spent $1,257 and $589, respectively. Another perk not available to the average rider. When Biden was late getting to the station, his friends at Amtrak waited for his arrival, causing the trains in the Eastern Corridor to run late. Making it a family affair once again, Biden's son Hunter was nominated to serve on the Amtrak Reform Board in 2006. Like his father, Hunter extolled the virtues of the government rail service, which he used to commute to New York for his hedge fund job before it went awry. As a quasi-governmental institution, Amtrak is forbidden by law from lobbying Congress. But as Politico reported, Hunter served as an effective advocate for the government railroad system. In February 2009, President Obama signed the $787 billion pork-stuffed economic stimulus package into law. During his address to a joint session of Congress after signing the bill, Obama designated Vice President Biden the stimulus spending watchdog to be perched at a new website, www.recovery.gov, and in charge of ensuring the money is spent wisely. A few weeks later, spending cop Biden announced that his beloved sinkhole Amtrak would get $1.3 billion of stimulus funds to expand passenger rail capacity and boost Delaware's economy. Biden couldn't be bothered to remember the name of his own website. He created a gaffe-tastic TV moment in late February 2009 when he blanked out on the internet address of recovery.gov. But Joe the backslapper never forgot to take care of his Amtrak cronies. Amtrak is not bent at the trough. Amtrak has been left out, Biden complained at an event celebrating the stimulus bounty. I'm tired of apologizing for help for Amtrak. And now, as head of the appropriately named RAT RAT Board, Recovery, Accountability, and Transparency Board, Biden will have wide-ranging powers over the inspectors general who've been tasked to independently investigate stimulus waste, fraud, and abuse. He'll have the power to initiate such probes, but more importantly for entrenched Democrats protecting powerful constituencies, the power to forestall such probes. Nobody messes with Joe, he bragged. Apparently the rich irony of appointing a deal-making, big-government Washington insider who shuns transparency and accountability to head up stimulus monitoring efforts was completely lost on the White House. It was not, however, lost on local officials who heard Vice President Biden threaten them if they squandered the funds on things like bike paths, swimming pools, and golf courses, which is, of course, precisely what's happening. Joseph Biden, Vice President of the United States. Because of the rules, the President and I can't stop you from doing some things, but I'll show up in your city and say, this was a stupid idea. You think I'm kidding? This is the only part the President was right about. Don't mess with Joe, because I mean it. I'm serious, guys. I'm serious. I'm absolutely serious. Biden's audience did what more and more audiences are doing when he opens his mouth. They laughed at him. Why? Because, as his lifelong public record shows, when it comes to ethical self-policing that puts taxpayer interests above electoral and special interests, Joe Biden doesn't have a serious bone in his body. Chapter 4. Meet the Mess, Inside the Crooked Cabinet. When asked why they were voting for Barack Obama, young people across the country cited his outsider status. Jose Villanueva, 21, a senior at Claremont McKenna College in California, told Time magazine he's new and modern and breaking with the past. 18-year-old Neil Stewart, a freshman at the University of Colorado in Boulder, echoed this sentiment. I like that he's new, Stewart enthused. We need some freshness in our government right now. Internet entrepreneurs cranked out Obama t-shirts emblazoned with hope is the new black and change is fresh. A comprehensive look at the men and women serving Barack Obama, however, exudes the freshness of a bologna sandwich left in a Lincoln town car parked in the muggy heat of Washington, D.C. in the middle of August, with the windows rolled up for a week. Within days of President Obama's swearing-in, the lemon-fresh scent of hope and change has been overpowered by the fetid odor of Beltway swamp business as usual. Without further ado, I've compiled for you a handy guide to Obama's team of moldy oldies, rancid hacks, and rank tax evaders. Perform an act of public service and share it with your favorite starry-eyed young Obama supporters. This is not the new they thought they knew. CIA Intelligence Director Leon Panetta, Lifestyles of the Rich and Entrenched. New York Democrat Senator Charles Schumer once called Leon Panetta the perfect government servant. He's also the perfect illustration of the Beltway swamp creature. After serving 16 years in Congress, 4 years in the Clinton administration as Budget Director and Chief of Staff, and a lifetime schmoozing in the halls of power, Panetta cashed in big. According to the Washingtonian magazine, Panetta, 70, is one of the administration's wealthiest members with up to $4 million in assets, demonstrating once more how lucrative government positions can be once they're no longer held. See also Clinton, Bill. While he has zero experience in intelligence matters, he has extensive experience in how to parlay his past political tours of duty into lucrative speaking gigs, consulting fees, and stock options. Indeed, the only central intelligence gathering duties Panetta has performed are at D.C. cocktail parties and corporate boardroom meetings picking up gossip. Team Obama wanted a nominee unstained by ties to Bush-era war on terror policies. What they settled for was a nominee unstained by any intellectual, managerial, or hands-on operational record on war on terror policies at all, unless you count his nasty office battles with former CIA Director James Woolsey over agency budget cuts during the Clinton era, or his op-ed against torture in the Washington Monthly in 2008. It wasn't only Republican partisans who questioned the crony CIA appointment. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Chair Democrat Dianne Feinstein of California was so dumbfounded by Panetta's nomination to helm the agency that she released a biting statement noting that her own position has consistently been that I believe the agency is best served by having an intelligence professional in charge at this time. An aide to Democrat Senator Jay Rockefeller pronounced his boss puzzled by the selection because he has always believed that the director of CIA needs to be someone with significant operational intelligence experience and someone outside the political realm. Defense analyst Michael O'Hanlon of the left-leaning Brookings Institution frowned on Panetta for never holding down a single major job in national security. The nomination, he said, seems to be Obama's weakest appointment in that sphere. Forced to disclose his financial assets and interests before his Senate confirmation, Panetta at least helped to inform the public of the lifestyles of the rich and entrenched. His disclosure forms show that he earned more than $1.2 million in investment, speaking, and consulting fees since the beginning of 2008, including $56,000 from Merrill Lynch and Company for two speeches, $28,000 for a speech for Covier Corporation, $28,000 for an honorarium from the Carlyle Group, a private equity firm whose companies do business with national security bureaucracies within the federal government, $60,000 in governmental advisory fees from the shipping lobbyists of the Pacific Maritime Association, $130,000 in director's fees from big-time lobbying firm Fleischmann Hillard, $150,000 in consulting fees from California State University, which hosts the Leon and Sylvia Panetta Institute for Public Policy, a nonprofit think tank run by Mr. Panetta and his wife, which, coincidentally enough, just happened to publish a survey showing wide support for Obama among college students in spring 2008 and disapproval of rival Republican John McCain and President George W. Bush. $125,000 in director fees from BP Corporation North America, $93,000 from Blue Shield of California, and $170,000 from Zenith National Insurance, in which he also owns stock worth up to $350,000. Technically speaking, lobbyist Light Panetta never registered as a federal lobbyist, so technically speaking, Obama did not violate his no lobbyists in charge hiring rule. But Hope and Change TM was supposed to be about the most qualified officials meeting the highest standards, not the most unqualified political hacks eking by on technicalities, wasn't it? Offering the emptiest reassurance, White House spokesman Tommy Vietor said Panetta's income and investments had been thoroughly reviewed by the Office of Government Ethics. Vietor instead touted Mr. Panetta's views about how to strengthen our intelligence gathering and keep our nation safe. But a vetting of Panetta's income and investments illustrates the fundamental problem with Obama's choice. He's an access traitor whose expertise lies not in national security, but in Washington job security. Commerce Secretary Gary Locke, Chinagate-tainted, interest-conflicted crony. After two botched attempts to fill the top post at the Commerce Department, the Obama White House finally settled on the former Democratic governor of Washington State, Gary Locke. Team Obama regarded Locke as, well, a lock. The national media dutifully towed the good Gary line. The Washington Post quoted officials touting him as a safe choice because of his long history in public life and his straight-laced reputation and his bipartisan governing credentials. The New York Times reported that Locke, the nation's first and only Chinese-American governor and now an expert on China issues as a partner in a prominent Seattle law firm, brings something new, an international focus, centrist pragmatism, strong skills in public policy, and a largely scandal-free resume. Obama's new commerce pick has clean reputation, declared National Public Radio. But repeating the Mr. Clean claim doesn't make it so. Locke's laces ain't tied so straight. I covered Locke when I worked at the Seattle Times in the late 1990s. I dealt with his campaign and gubernatorial staffs. Straight-laced and clean reputation are not the phrases I'd use for my dealings with him and his people. Those in his home state who know Locke best paint a far grimier picture of a crony politician with a serial habit of skirting campaign finance laws and conflict of interest rules. In other words, Locke's spotty record made him a good fit for the ethically impaired Obama administration. The left-leaning Seattle Weekly newspaper notes that Locke presided over a $3.2 billion tax break for Boeing as governor while never disclosing he paid $715,000 to and relied on the advice of Boeing's own private consultant and outside auditor for advice. The state paid the auditor, Deloitte Consulting, the $715,000 in taxpayer funds to help land the Boeing Dreamliner assembly plant with the largest tax incentive in Washington state history. Oh, and Boeing just happened to be a $5 million Deloitte client. Great coinkydinks. Then there's the tainted matter of Locke's favors for his brother-in-law, who lived in the governor's mansion, including a tax break for his relative's company, personal intervention in a company dispute, and Locke's signature on a federal loan application for the company. Republicans inquiring into the contract determined there was no illegality, but it was just too close for comfort for some ethics watchdogs. The Seattle Weekly's Rick Anderson reported that Locke's brother-in-law, Judd Lee, served as chief financial officer for Safe Harbor Technology. The company snagged a master contract from the state after Locke promoted it and championed nearly $12.7 million in tax breaks and state economic aid to benefit the company and its industry. In addition, Governor Locke aided his brother-in-law's company by funneling federal aid to it through a public corporation pipeline. Locke denied any conflict of interest and maintained that he never spoke about business to the brother-in-law, who lived in his gubernatorial mansion and frequently brought guests to tour the stately home. Well, duh, he didn't have to say a word. The language of nepotism is always spoken with winks and nudges. Most alarming, the glowing profiles of Locke largely glossed over his troubling ties to the Clinton-era Chinagate scandal. As the nation's first Chinese-American governor, Locke aggressively raised cash from ethnic constituencies around the country. Convicted campaign finance money launderer John Huang helped grease the wheels and open doors. In the same time period he was drumming up illegal cash for Clinton-Gore at the federal level, Huang ordered two 1996 galas for Locke in Washington, D.C., where Locke hobnobbed with Clinton and other Chinagate principals, three fundraisers in Los Angeles, and an extravaganza at the Universal City, California Hilton in October 1996 that raised upwards of $30,000. Huang also made personal contributions to Locke, as did another Clinton-Gore funny money figure, Indonesian business mogul Ted Siang and his family and political operatives. Swing, whom Justice Department and intelligence officials suspected of acting on behalf of the Chinese government, illegally donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to both Democrat and Republican coffers. Checks to Locke's campaign poured in from prominent Huang and Siang associates, many of whom were targets of federal investigations, including Hoyt Zia, a Commerce Department counsel, who stated in a sworn deposition that Huang had access to virtually any classified document through him. Melinda Yi, another Clinton Commerce Department official who admitted to destroying Freedom of Information Act protected notes on a China trade mission involving Huang's former employer, the Indonesia-based Lippo Group. Preetun Kanchanalak, mother of convicted Thai influence peddler Pauline Kanchanalak and Kent La, exclusive distributor of Siang's Chinese cigarettes in the United States and Siang's wife and son-in-law. Bank records from congressional investigators also indicated that an associate of Siang made a maximum individual contribution to Locke that was then illegally reimbursed by Siang's daughter. Locke eventually returned a token amount of money from Huang and Kanchanalak, but not before bitterly playing the race card and accusing critics of his sloppy accounting and questionable schmoozing of stirring up anti-Asian American sentiment. It'll make our efforts doubly hard to get Asian Americans appointed to top-level positions across the United States, Locke complained. If they have any connection to John Huang, those individuals will face greater scrutiny and their lives will be completely opened up and examined, perhaps more than usual. The scrutiny, such as it was more than justified. On top of his Chinagate entanglements, Locke's political committee was fined the maximum amount by Washington's campaign finance watchdog for failing to disclose out-of-state New York City Chinatown donor events. One of those events was held at New York City's Harmony Palace restaurant, co-owned by Chinese street gang thugs. And then there were Locke's not-so-squeaky-clean fundraising trips to a Buddhist temple in Redmond, Washington, which netted nearly $14,000 from monks and nuns, many of whom barely spoke English, couldn't recall donating to Locke, or were out of the country and could never be located. Of the known temple donors identified by the Locke campaign, five gave $1,000 each on July 22, 1996, paid in sequentially ordered cashier's checks. Two priests gave $1,000 and $1,100 respectively on August 8, 1996. Three other temple adherents also gave $1,000 contributions on August 8th. Internal campaign records show that two other temple disciples donated $2,000 and $1,000 respectively on other dates. State campaign finance investigators failed to track down some of the donors during their probe. But while investigating the story for the Seattle Times, I interviewed temple donor Sui Hui Huang, a bald-robed 40-year-old priest who could not remember when or by what means he had given a $1,000 contribution to Locke. He also refused to say whether he was a U.S. citizen, explaining that his English was not so good. Although an inept state campaign finance panel absolved Locke and his campaign of any wrongdoing, the extensive public record clearly shows that the Locke campaign used Buddhist monks as conduits for laundered money. The longtime reluctance to press Locke, who became a high-powered attorney specializing in China trade issues for international law firm Davis Wright & Tremaine after leaving the governor's mansion on his reckless, ethnic-based fundraising extended to the politically correct and cowed Beltway. Instead of questioning his abysmal judgment, supporters touted Locke's cozy relations with the Chinese government as a primary reason he deserves the Commerce Department post. He sailed through the Senate confirmation process with GOP Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson cluelessly concluding that Locke's background check was boring. Thanks to Republicans asleep at the wheel, Teflon Gary evaded tough scrutiny once again. Like Panetta, he skirted Obama's no-lobbyist rule despite having lobbied the Chinese government on behalf of Microsoft, Starbucks, Weyerhaeuser Timber, and other Washington state businesses. He traveled five times to China, seeking loosened restrictions and favors for his clients, including an American bank seeking to establish a presence in the communist regime. He also served as a fixer for Chinese nationals, demanding streamlined visa applications, and as a travel agent for Chinese President Hu Jintao when he visited the United States in 2006. But since Locke didn't lobby the U.S. government, Obama didn't count his lobbying work as lobbying. See no lobbying, hear no lobbying, speak no lobbying. We are confident, a White House aide insisted, that Governor Locke will be able to continue to advocate on behalf of American businesses and workers while at the same time adhering to the administration's ethics policy. Confidence built on delusion, an unmistakable mark of the Obama administration beast. HUD's number two man, Ron Sims, enemy of transparency. If you need a simple, shining example of the utter disingenuousness of Barack Obama's commitment to government transparency, I have two words for you. Ron Sims, the lifelong political hack, is to transparency what sunlight is to Dracula, what salt is to a slug, what kryptonite is to Superman, what The View is to intelligent debate. That is lethal. In its press release announcing the nomination of the Seattle area county executive to the number two post at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the White House described Sims as a visionary urban leader. The White House also touted Sims' willingness to make the tough choices necessary to ensure that American tax dollars are spent wisely. But his key accomplishments in the Pacific Northwest have involved illegally keeping taxpayers in the dark. Despite his long-known notoriety in Washington state, as an incompetent manager and obstinate campaign finance lawbreaker, President Obama has entrusted Sims to oversee the day-to-day operations of a federal agency with 8,500 employees, a $39 billion yearly budget, and a chronic history of corruption and cronyism. Here's what fellow Seattle liberal Ted Van Dyke, a veteran Democratic strategist who supported Obama, said when Sims' nomination was announced. It's hard to imagine someone less qualified as Deputy Housing and Urban Development Secretary than Ron Sims. Sims' weak suit as King County executive was his administrative competence. His troubles with the county jail, elections office, sewage treatment facility, and transportation planning are well known. Like former Washington State Governor turned Obama Commerce Secretary Gary Locke, he is personable. A nice guy. But the HUD deputy's job is to administer and run day-to-day a department notorious for its scandals, corruption, and screw-ups, while the secretary serves as outside man. Unless he's careful, HUD will eat Sims alive. The folks who have fought the real Ron Sims in his own backyard know he is the very antithesis of an open, accountable public servant. Ask Armin Yusofian. In 1997, the former Boeing engineer embarked on what would be a 12-year legal battle to force Sims to obey public disclosure rules, instead of making the tough choices necessary to ensure that American tax dollars are spent wisely. Sims did everything in his power to ensure that King County, Washington taxpayers were deprived of vital information on how their money was being spent. Yusofian wanted access to government documents related to a sports stadium subsidy plan up for a vote in Washington in the summer of 1997. The records he requested at the end of May 1997 pertained to the fiscal impact of a massive tax hike proposal to build a new football palace for the Seattle Seahawks. Time was of the essence. County residents were preparing to vote on a ballot initiative package worth $300 million on June 17, 1997. Boosters of similar public-private stadium partnerships had made dubious claims of economic windfalls that never transpired. Yusofian, serving as the watchdog that Sims failed to be for his constituents, was absolutely right to question the numbers. But Sims, leading stadium subsidy booster and corporate water carrier for Microsoft billionaire and Seahawks owner Paul Allen, didn't put an informed citizenry first. His office deliberately stonewalled Yusofian's request, at first failing to deliver the documents, then claiming they didn't exist, and then admonishing him to bug off because he had been given everything he requested. All lies. While Sims' deputies gave Yusofian the grand runaround, Referendum 48 passed by a margin of 51-49. Yusofian launched a one-man crusade to hold Sims accountable to taxpayers. He sued under Washington's open records law in 2000. He spent $330,000 of his own money in legal fees and 4,000 hours of his own time. A lower court ruled in his favor, dinging the county's obstructionism as egregious, but skimped in awarding him the minimum $5 a day for each of the 8,252 days that Sims's office withheld the documents. The courts found hundreds of instances where Sims's office deceived Yusofian or refused to tell the truth. To deter future abuse, Yusofian appealed for higher fines. A lower court came back and awarded him $15 a day, for a total of $124,000 in penalties and attorney's fees of $171,100. The largest fine of its kind ever assessed under the law, and it was still not enough for public officials to treat it as anything other than a minor cost of doing business. Yusofian pointed out, after that ruling, that he still did not receive all the documents he requested, and that the outcome meant most people will never get a lawyer to take such a case without being paid hourly, as there just isn't enough potential for penalties to make a contingent fee arrangement worthwhile. Yusofian appealed again to the state Supreme Court in January 2009, just weeks before President Obama tapped Sims for the number 2 HUD post. The High Court issued an historic ruling in Yusofian's favor, damning Sims's blatant violations of the State Public Records Act. From the majority opinion in Yusofian versus Office of Ron Sims. To summarize, the unchallenged findings of fact demonstrate King County repeatedly deceived and misinformed Yusofian for years. King County told Yusofian it produced all the requested documents when in fact it had not. King County told Yusofian archives were being searched and records compiled when in fact they were not. King County told Yusofian the information was located elsewhere when in fact it was not. After years of delay, misrepresentation, and ineptitude on the part of King County, Yusofian filed suit. Nevertheless, it would still take another year for King County to completely and accurately respond to Yusofian's original request, well past the purpose of his request, the referendum on public financing of a sports stadium. King County failed to reply to Yusofian's clear request promptly or accurately. King County failed to train its responding personnel or supervise its response. King County did not comply strictly to the procedures set forth in RCW 4256-520, failing to seek clarification from Yusofian when necessary, failing to give any reason for its delay, failing to set forth an exception for its refusal, failing to provide any estimate of its delayed response time, and making Yusofian contact King County more than 11 times over the course of 2 years to obtain the requested information when under the statute only one request should suffice. King County either made no explanation of its noncompliance or misrepresented the truth. As the trial judge found, with proper diligence and attention, King County could have responded accurately to Yusofian within 5 days. The potential for public harm was high. The requested records tested the veracity of King County's assertions regarding a pending referendum and a $300 million public financing scheme. The request was time-sensitive, seeking documents relevant to the upcoming referendum, whereas the disclosure of these documents was delayed years beyond the election day without justification. This travesty is the singular responsibility of Ron Sims. It dragged on through his entire tenure as King County executive and beyond. The state Supreme Court remanded the case back to the lower courts to determine a final fine that may exceed some $1 million in taxpayer funds. Sims' pattern of evasion was no anomaly. In 2005, another citizen filed suit against Sims for violating public disclosure rules. Seattle resident and blogger Stefan Sharkansky had requested documents related to the November 2004 election, which at the gubernatorial level was marked by fraud allegations across Washington state. The election records revealed that Sims' office unlawfully counted hundreds of ineligible ballots in the governor's race. As Sharkansky alleged in his complaint, which was scheduled to go to trial in April 2009, 1. On December 27, 2004, I submitted a public records request to the county for a list of all King County voters who submitted ballots in the November 2nd election. The county did not satisfy this request in full until September 12, 2005. It took me at least 4 more letters and the presentation of irrefutable evidence from other documents to override King County's insistence that they didn't have the documents I was asking for, and which revealed the existence of dozens of unlawfully counted ballots, among other things. 2. On April 7, 2005, I submitted through my attorney a public records request for copies of both the absentee ballot outer envelope and the provisional ballot envelope for 91 known voters who submitted both types of ballots. As of July 5, 2005, the county had not produced any of the absentee and provisional ballot envelopes I had requested, so I renewed my request and asked to examine all the original absentee ballot envelopes. The county finally responded July 14, 2005, stating that only 27 out of 91 of the provisional ballots were found, and estimating that the other documents would be produced July 22, 2005. I appeared at the elections office on July 25, 2005, and received only 27 provisional ballots out of 91 identified. On September 2, 2005, the county informed me that only one additional provisional ballot envelope responsive to my request had been located. On September 16, 2005, I obtained permission to examine the contents of a box marked Provisional Ballot Envelopes, November 2004. Inside were approximately 59 more envelopes responsive to my request of April 7, 2005. If King County had released the documents that other folks and I requested 6 to 10 months ago in a complete and timely fashion, losing GOP gubernatorial candidate Dino Rossi's legal team would have been able to present a much stronger argument that official misconduct occurred. What we've seen is not just a lazy agency dragging its heels to respond to document requests, but an organized effort to cover up official misconduct and to obstruct justice. On April 24, 2009, King County settled out of court with Sharkansky for $225,000, one of the largest settlements for public records violations in state history. Less than a week after the January 2009 ruling against the man he would elevate to manage day-to-day operations at HUD, President Obama signed with great fanfare a Freedom of Information Act memorandum declaring his commitment to open government. The Freedom of Information Act should be administered with a clear presumption. In the face of doubt, openness prevails. The government should not keep information confidential merely because public officials might be embarrassed by disclosure, because errors and failures might be revealed, or because of speculative or abstract fears. Non-disclosure should never be based on an effort to protect the personal interests of government officials at the expense of those they are supposed to serve. In responding to requests under the FOIA, executive branch agencies should act promptly and in a spirit of cooperation, recognizing that such agencies are servants of the public. All agencies should adopt a presumption of favor of disclosure in order to renew their commitment to the principles embodied in FOIA and to usher in a new era of open government. As veteran Open Records attorney Greg Overstreet, another Washington State citizens advocate who knows Sims best, jibed, "Let's hope President Obama is not relying on Ron Sims to carry out the president's transparency agenda. Irony doesn't just abound, it reeks." Attorney General Eric Holder, crime-coddling corporate lawyer. "Don't go into corporate America," First Lady Michelle Obama admonished supporters on the campaign trail. Remember, she extolled the rewards of public service over the material perks of life at a high-powered law firm. She certainly didn't take her own advice, and neither did her husband's own attorney general. If he hadn't pulled out all the stops campaigning for the president, raising money at lavish celebrity events, and offering his strategic and legal advice, and if Eric Holder had an R by his name instead of a D, he might have served as the perfect poster boy for Mrs. O's caustic campaign against white shoe corporate law. After a quarter century as a government lawyer, Holder joined the prestigious Covington & Burlington business and corporate law firm. He represented a gallery of the left's fattest targets in big pharma and big business, defending them in fraud and discrimination cases that drove progressives mad. Holder has served both as corporate and government masters well, and he has the bank account and stock portfolio to prove it. His salary jumped from under $200,000 as Deputy U.S. Attorney General for the Clinton administration to more than $2 million a year as a Covington & Burlington senior partner. During 2008, Holder spent countless hours away from his corporate office working for the Obama campaign, raising money, fielding calls, making speeches. "I hope the management committee is going to be real understanding when they see my billable hours this year," Holder joked to the American lawyer. "It's an investment, of course, and the law firm will get its political dividends later." Holder returns to a more modest $186,000 salary as Obama's attorney general. But parting has its perks, too. The Washington revolving door pays. Covington & Burling will make a separation payment valued at between $1 million and $5 million, plus a repayment of up to $1 million from the firm's capital account, plus a retirement plan of up to $500,000. His net worth, $5.7 million. Reflecting on his past 8 years, raking in the dough and watching him schmooze friends and clients from his elegant new Manhattan offices, an American lawyer profile observed, "Life is good for private citizen Eric Holder, Jr." President Obama and the Mrs., such outspoken detractors of climbing the corporate ladder and influence peddling, were unavailable for comment. One wonders what the Obamas would say about Holder's lucrative work for Chiquita Brands International if it had been performed by, say, John McCain's top lawyer. As chief counsel for the global company, Holder won a slap-on-the-wrist plea deal to charges that it had paid off Colombian paramilitary death squads. Liberal critics of Holder point out that he used his influence as a former Clinton Justice Department official to negotiate a sweetheart deal for Chiquita. The company pleaded guilty to illegally doing business with the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, or AUC, designated as an international terrorist organization by the State Department in 2001. Chiquita admitted negotiating with and forking over $1.7 million in protection racket money to the guerrillas beginning in 1997. AUC terrorists slaughtered thousands of civilians to gain control of Colombia's banana fields. The company ignored the advice of outside counsel, not Holder or anyone else at Covington & Burling, to stop the illegal payments in 2003. Must stop payments. Bottom line, cannot make the payment. Advised not to make alternative payment through Convivir. General rule, cannot do indirectly what you cannot do directly. Concluded with cannot make the payment. You voluntarily put yourself in this position. Duress defense can wear out through repetition. Business decision to stay in harm's way. Chiquita should leave Colombia. The company should not continue to make the Santa Marta payments, given the AUC's designation as a foreign terrorist organization. The company should not make the payment. Even after disclosing the payments to the Justice Department in the spring of 2003, Chiquita continued funneling money to the terrorists. According to the Justice Department, from April 24, 2003, the date of Chiquita's initial disclosure to the Justice Department, through February 4, 2004, Chiquita made 20 payments to the AUC totaling over $300,000. And yet, despite knowingly and repeatedly breaking the law, not a single Chiquita official was prosecuted or jailed. The $25 million criminal fine was written off as the cost of doing business. And stunningly, the plea agreement forged by Holder and the DOJ succeeded in protecting the identities of the executives involved in the bloody terrorist payoffs. Putting on the best terrorist defense is a Covington & Burling specialty. Among the firm's other celebrity terrorist clients, 17 Yemenis held at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. The law firm employed dozens of radical attorneys such as David Reams and Mark Volkoff to provide the enemy combatants with more than 3,000 hours of pro bono representation. Covington and Burling co-authored one of three petitioners' briefs filed in the Boumediene versus Bush detainee case and secured victories for several other Gitmo enemy combatants in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Falkoff went on to publish a book of poetry, Poems from Guantanamo, The Detainees Speak, which he dedicated to the suspected terrorists. For my friends inside the wire, Maumoud, Majid, Yassin, Saeed, Abdul Salam, Mohammed, Adnan, Jamal, Othman, Adil, Mohammed, Abdul Malik, Arif, Adek, Farouk, Salman, and Maktar. Inshallah, we will meet over coffee in your homes in Yemen. How sweet, one of the class of Yemeni Gitmo detainees that Falkoff described as gentle, thoughtful young men, was released in 2005, only to blow himself up, gently and thoughtfully, of course, in a truck bombing in Mosul, Iraq, in 2008, killing 13 soldiers from the 2nd Iraqi Army Division and seriously wounding 42 others. The Senate shrugged at the glaring conflict of interest Attorney General Holder presents in handling Gitmo legal issues. Lieutenant Colonel Gordon Kukulu, author of Inside Gitmo, The True Story Behind the Myths of Guantanamo Bay, makes the ethical problem plain. As a senior partner, he undoubtedly had significant input on what kind of charity cases his firm picked up. He surely knew that dozens of lawyers from his firm were among the 500-plus civilian lawyers representing the 244 or so remaining detainees on top of military court-appointed defenders. Even now, his Covington colleagues continue to allege rampant torture at Gitmo. They're fighting hard to have detainees tried through the U.S. court system, essentially given the same rights as U.S. citizens. And their arguments and plans hinge largely on having Holder issue a bad report card. Recent polls indicate that at least half of Americans disagree with affording the detainees legal rights on U.S. soil. Will they have the same access to Holder's ears as his former colleagues do? The White House says that Holder will formally recuse himself from charging decisions and prosecutions affecting any of Covington and Burling's clients, but he will have unfettered oversight over Obama's order to close the facility within a year. Moreover, there's a gaping loophole in the Obama administration ethics rules that will allow Holder to participate in decision-making despite his conflicts of interest if he can show that his participation in a matter outweighs an appearance or actual conflict of interest. If you think Holder's professional connections won't have any influence on the outcome of these decisions, I have a Colombian banana farm to sell you. Among the other eyebrow-raising cases Holder took on at Covington and Burling, signing up to assist them then-Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich in a casino license battle in 2004. The state's gaming board had approved the construction of a disputed casino, overruling the recommendation of the board's staff. Rank-and-file investigators had qualms over the casino developer's alleged mob ties and over Blago's appointment of a crony fundraiser to oversee the state's deal-making with the casino. The fundraiser, Christopher Kelly, turned out to be a business partner of convicted Obama Blago confidant and real estate mogul Tony Rezko. The Chicago Sun-Times reported that Rezko held an option to lease a hotel site next to the proposed casino site. Holder held a public press conference with Blago to announce his role as a special independent investigator into the matter. The Dog and Pony Show produced no report, but Holder and his law firm had contracted to conduct the probe for a tidy $300,000. Somehow the foul-smelling case slipped Holder's mind. He failed to mention it in his Senate Judiciary Committee questionnaire. Forging a massive settlement for Purdue Pharma, manufacturer of the addictive painkiller OxyContin, with the state of West Virginia in 2004. The state accused the drug maker of deceptively marking OxyContin as safe and effective for minor pain. The firm's marketing practices, the state maintained, led to West Virginia users becoming addicted to the drug. State Attorney General Daryl McGraw Jr., a Democrat, filed suit. In an article entitled, Why Eric Holder Represents What's Wrong with Washington, liberal columnist David Korn described Holder's pivotal role in negotiating a settlement that spared executives a criminal trial. This suit was a serious threat to the drug maker, and it eventually called in Holder. And in November 2004, the morning that the case was about to go to trial, Holder helped negotiate a settlement. Working in the judge's chambers in West Virginia, he forged an agreement under which the firm would have to pay $10 million over 4 years into drug abuse and education programs in West Virginia. Purdue would not have to admit any wrongdoing. Days earlier, the firm had offered the state about $2 million to settle. McGraw had turned down Purdue and had not bothered to produce a counteroffer. The settlement was a big win for the company. $10 million was a piddling amount compared to what Purdue was reaping from OxyContin sales. More important, this settlement helped keep the lid on the firm's criminal activities. There would be no trial and no public release of documents or testimony about the company's actions, which were already being investigated by federal prosecutors. In late 2002, the feds had begun an investigation of Purdue with the first of what would be nearly 600 subpoenas for corporate records related to the manufacturing, marketing, and distribution of OxyContin. In May 2007, the company and its three top executives pleaded guilty to federal charges of fraudulently marketing OxyContin by claiming it was less addictive, less subject to abuse, and less likely to cause withdrawal symptoms. Purdue and the three execs agreed to pay fines of $634.5 million. Brokering a settlement for pharmaceutical kingpin Merck, which had been besieged by multiple state lawsuits over Medicaid overbilling and doctor kickbacks involving four popular drugs, Merck admitted no wrongdoing, paying $671 million to make whistleblowers, state probes over their pricing, and bribery charges go away. In his Tony Manhattan offices, Holder did what any corporate lawyer worth his multi-million-dollar salary and benefits package would do: represent his clients to the best of his ability. But in his first tours of duty as a government lawyer, Holder repeatedly put politics above the national interest. During his Senate confirmation hearing, Holder's infamous roles in issuing pardons to Clinton crony Mark Rich and clemency to convicted bank robbers and bombers of the Puerto Rican terrorist group FALN, Fuerzas Armadas de la Liberación Nacional, received the most heat. In both cases, the government servant played a far more active role in intervening than he ever cared to admit.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
The Los Angeles Times added new information to the terrorist clemency case by disclosing before the hearing that Holder had repeatedly pushed some of his subordinates at the Clinton Justice Department to drop their opposition to the FALN commutations. Holder, the paper determined from whistleblower interviews and documents, played an active role in changing the position of the Justice Department to facilitate President Clinton's commutations for 16 violent terrorists from the group. The FALN had waged a bloody bombing campaign that maimed dozens of New York City police officers and resulted in the deaths or injuries of scores of other victims. Holder forged ahead with his meddling on behalf of the president against the protests of the FBI, NYPD, federal prosecutors, and victims. The nation's top law enforcer did not pay the bombing victims or their families the courtesy of notifying them of the decision to release the unrepentant terrorists until after the clemencies were publicized in the media. As for the Mark Rich case, former federal prosecutor Andrew McCarthy accurately described it as one of the most disgraceful chapters in the history of the Justice Department. Congressional investigators called it unconscionable. Fugitive commodities trader Mark Rich, on the run for evading nearly $50 million in taxes, found the best lawyer he could buy: former Democratic White House counsel and intimate friend of Eric Holder, Jack Quinn. Despite his denials, memos showed Holder knew of the pardon in advance, failed to notify prosecutors and the FBI that it was coming, and even gave Quinn public relations advice on getting out the legal merits of the case. The evidence clearly shows Holder and Quinn violated department protocols and colluded to keep the Justice Department out of the pardon deal. Appearing contrite at his Senate confirmation hearing, Holder confessed, I've accepted the responsibility of making those mistakes. I've never tried to hide. I've never tried to blame anybody else. What I've always said was that given the opportunity to do it differently, I certainly would have. I should have made sure that everybody, all the prosecutors in that case, were informed of what was going on. I made assumptions that turned out not to be true. I should not have spoken to the White House and expressed an opinion without knowing all the facts with regard to that matter. That was and remains the most intense, most searing experience I've ever had as a lawyer. There were questions raised about me that I was not used to hearing. I've learned from that experience. I think that, as perverse as this might sound, I will be a better attorney general should I be confirmed having had the Mark Rich experience. It was something that I think is not typical of the way in which I've conducted myself as a careful, thoughtful lawyer. As I said, it is something where I made mistakes and I've learned from those mistakes. Washington, alas, was determined to repeat the mistakes of the past. The Senate, including 19 Republicans, confirmed Holder on February 2, 2009. A month later, the Washington Post reported that Holder politicized the legal review process involving the contentious issue of D.C. voting rights. After careful study, the DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, had issued an opinion that a House bill on the matter was unconstitutional. Holder, who supports D.C. voting rights along with President Obama, overrode his staff lawyer's ruling and simply ordered up an alternative opinion that fit the White House agenda. Despite assuring the Senate that he would not change OLC opinions simply because a new administration takes over and pledging that legal reviews would not be a political process but will be one based solely on our interpretation of the law, Holder did exactly that. Former OLC Principal Deputy Edward Whelan noted that Holder refused to make the OLC opinion on D.C. voting rights available and did not issue a signed opinion explaining his grounds for reversal. No transparency, no accountability, no surprise. U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk, tax cheat. I think of Barack Obama as a genius. Late-night talk show host Jay Leno joked amid a flurry of tax-cheating Obama nominations, I think this is part of the plan. Do you ever notice when Barack Obama nominates someone, the first thing they do is pay their taxes? He's found a way to pay off the deficit. Nominate every single person in the country one at a time until they pay off the deficit. Unfortunately, the White House didn't need comedians to come up with more laughs. They just kept producing new punchlines. In March 2009, Obama tapped former Dallas Mayor Ron Kirk to take the U.S. Trade Representative's post. Investigators determined that Kirk owed close to $10,000 in back taxes on claimed deductions for Dallas Mavericks sports tickets and donated speaking fees in 2005, 2006, and 2007. In the most egregious instance, Kirk improperly deducted more than $17,000 as entertainment expenses for the cost of Mavericks tickets, nearly half of which was not sustained. Why Kirk's tax troubles were deemed minor by the White House, while those of would-be performance czar Nancy Kleffer, who withdrew from her nomination over unpaid household taxes worth a tenth as much as Kirk's, became a major issue, is a question Obama's feminist supporters curiously failed to ask. In any case, Capitol Hill fell in line and agreed with the White House that he was the right man for the job, and Jay Leno's mockery of the party of tax cheats hit the nail on the head. I guess the Democrats think IRS means I'm really sorry. HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, the nominee who couldn't count. She was supposed to be a safe choice after the Daschle debacle, but Democrat Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius came with her own set of tax troubles and accounting problems. In March 2009, she admitted in a letter disclosed to the press that she had made unintentional errors on her taxes and corrected her returns from three different years. The Democrat head of the Senate Finance Committee rushed to support her. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that Governor Sebelius has the political experience, determination, and bipartisan work ethic to get the job done with Congress this year, Senator Max Baucus wrote. She's the right person for the job. By now, the public was learning that the right person for the job was code for tax scofflaw in the age of Obama. Sebelius coughed up $7,000 in back taxes, along with $878 in interest for debt owed between 2005 and 2007. 2 weeks later, more trouble with math. Sibelius was forced to admit that she lowballed the amount of political contributions she had received from infamous late-term abortion doctor George Tiller. In a letter to the Senate Finance Committee dated April 2, 2009, Sibelius revealed that she had received nearly three times as much cash from Tiller as she had initially disclosed. Here is the full question and response between GOP Senator John Kyle and Sibelius.
There's been a lot of attention concerning your relationship with George Tiller, a doctor who has performed late-term abortions in Kansas. Can you describe your relationship with Mr. Tiller? Has he ever contributed to your campaign, or has your PAC ever received money from Mr. Tiller or PAC related to Mr. Tiller? Have you ever hosted Mr. Tiller at an event during your tenure as governor of Kansas?
Answer: I regret that there was an inadvertent omission in my previous response to this question. The oversight led to an incomplete listing of certain PAC contributions, as well as contributions from Dr. Tiller's business. After a further review of the records at the Kansas Governmental Ethics Commission, including electronic records and all available paper records dating back to 1986, I have provided an updated answer below. I have been familiar with Dr. Tiller for many years because he lives and works in Kansas. Like many Kansans, he contributed to my campaign for insurance commissioner. He also contributed to the Bluestem Fund, a leadership PAC established primarily to support candidates for the Kansas legislature. Between 1990 and 2001, my campaign received $11,100 from Dr. Tiller. In addition, my campaign also received $2,250 from Mrs. Tiller, $2,250 from Women's Healthcare Services, and $1,000 from the Pro-Choice Action League, which in media reports has been associated with Dr. Tiller. In 2000, the Bluestem Fund received $10,000 from Dr. Tiller. In addition, between 2001 and 2002, the Bluestem Fund received $13,000 from Women's Healthcare Services. I am aware of no donations from Dr. Tiller, from any PAC related to him, from Mrs. Tiller, or from Women's Healthcare Services since 2002. Throughout the course of my career, I have donated a lunch, dinner, or reception to nonprofit organizations at their annual auctions. I did so every year as insurance commissioner, and have done so every year as governor. In 2006, I donated a reception at Cedar Crest to the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus for their annual fundraiser, the Torch Dinner. Dr. Tiller bid on and won that auction item. As a result, an afternoon event lasting approximately 1 hour was held at Cedar Crest with Dr. Tiller and his staff in attendance. All costs were reimbursed to the state. Funny how all these unintentional goofs, errors, and financial misstatements always err on the side of understating the problem. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, self-lobbying union lackey. Upon presenting her with the 2000 Profile and Courage Award, Senator Ted Kennedy praised California Democrat Congresswoman Hilda Solis for her ability and dedication to overcome the entrenched opposition of special interest groups. Solis, Kennedy waxed, was the fulfillment of the American dream. If your dream is for an America where cronies can come in all colors and climb the political ladder with the patronage of big labor, indeed, Hilda Solis certainly fits the bill. Solis' father, Raul, was a Teamsters Union shop steward from Mexico. Her mother, Juana, was an assembly line worker from Nicaragua. Born in Los Angeles, Solis served in the state legislature for 8 years before winning a congressional seat against a fellow Democrat, 71-year-old, nine-term incumbent Matthew Martinez in 2000. Martinez angered powerful unions in Southern California with his support of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Solis eagerly carried the organized labor banner. Organized labor, in return, showered her with financial affection. To help ensure her upset defeat of Martinez, the Political Action Committee of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, gave her a maximum $5,000 donation, but more important, it supplied her with nearly 300 rank-and-file canvassers and ground troops. "I wouldn't be here were it not for my friends in the labor movement," she gushed at her victory speech. A look at Solis' campaign coffers underscores that debt of gratitude. Over 4 terms in Congress, Solis has pocketed more than $900,000 in campaign contributions from unions, including $264,300 from building trade unions, $180,500 from industrial unions,
$162,550 from public sector unions and $153,500 from transportation unions. Labor bosses turned cartwheels when the White House tapped her on December 18, 2008, for the cabinet post. SEIU godfather Andy Stern called it extraordinary. See Chapter 7 for more on the Obama-SEIU-Stern axis. Democrats extolled Solis's knowledge and leadership on work issues. But during her confirmation hearing, Solis dodged questions from Republicans on right-to-work laws that prevent requiring membership in a union as a condition of employment. Solis hemmed and hawed before asserting, "I don't believe that I'm qualified to address that at this time." Solis also punted on questions about the number one agenda item of her union patrons, the so-called Employee Free Choice Act, or Card Check Bill, which would obliterate secret ballot elections in union organizing and increase pressure on workers to organize against their will. "My position as a nominee for President-elect Obama to serve as Secretary of Labor doesn't, in my opinion, afford me the ability to provide you with an opinion at this time." Solis acted more like a Supreme Court nominee than a cabinet appointee, bobbing and weaving as if direct answers would jeopardize a future court case. "Senator, I would just say to you that that is an item of great interest to me. I think that that is something that I am not able to speak to you about at this time, but will like to review and then come back to you personally on that matter. I would like to explore that more with this committee, but that's something that I think I'm not prepared to give you a complete answer on at this time." Republican Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming blasted Solis's evasions. "What answers? She doesn't even recognize her own record when giving the answers." Indeed, Solis was a co-sponsor of the very card check legislation she refused to talk about at her hearing. Moreover, she served as director and treasurer of a union-promoting lobbying group, American Rights at Work, which was pushing her card check bill. On top of that, Solis failed to disclose those positions to the House on her financial disclosure forms. In effect, she was lobbying herself as former Federal Election Commissioner and Justice Department official Hans A. von Spakovsky put it. Neat trick, huh? Wait, that's not all. Solis' self-lobbying group took in at least $1 million in contributions from labor unions and spent thousands of dollars on television spots described by the group in its report to the FEC as electioneering communications. Those ads targeted Republican incumbent senators Norm Coleman, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Gordon Smith, and John Sununu. The scheme circumvented vaunted McCain-Feingold campaign finance reforms barring so-called soft money donations from unions and corporations alike. Despite apparent violations of both basic disclosure and campaign finance rules, Solis skated. She signed an affidavit stating that she didn't control her lobbying group's funds, even though she was its treasurer and a board member. The GOP was ready to roll over. And then, just hours before the nomination vote, the Obama White House sheepishly disclosed that Solis's husband had just paid 16-year-old tax liens worth about $6,400. According to USA Today, Los Angeles County record showed 15 outstanding state and county tax liens against Sam Sayad and his auto repair business, totaling $7,630. Two other liens worth $981 were released in 1999 after Sayad repaid the taxes owed, according to county records. After the requisite eyebrow furrowing, Solis coasted to victory. Or rather, her special interest patrons in big labor coasted to victory. The union boss's dream fulfilled. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, earmark man. There was much ado about President Obama's unprecedented choice of Republican Congressman Ray LaHood to lead the Department of Transportation. Never mind that GOP President George W. Bush tapped Democrat Norman Netta in the previous administration. Paeans to reaching across the aisle and working together resounded among the chattering classes. Ray's appointment reflects that bipartisan spirit, a spirit we need to reclaim in this country to make progress for the American people, Obama said, in cheerleading himself and his pick. But donkeys and elephants have always come together in the spirit of expanding government, rolling logs, and barreling pork.